Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline is not with us today, but tune in a week or two and she'll be back. We have a repeat guest with us today. And Lisa Unger writes some of my favorite thrillers. She is a New York Times and internationally best-selling author with books published in 26 languages and millions of copies sold worldwide. She's widely regarded as a master of suspense. Her new release that we're talking about today is Confessions on the 745. Her critically acclaimed books have been named on best book lists from The Today Show, Good Morning America, Entertainment Weekly, People, Amazon, Goodreads, and many others. She's been nominated for many awards and won many awards, and her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, NPR, and Travel and Leisure. She lives on the west coast of Florida with her family, and welcome back to Writers' Voices, Lisa.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Monica. I'm thrilled.
So are we. So let's just start right out the gate. What's Confessions on the 745? What's it about?
Okay, so at the beginning of Confessions, we meet a young working mom. Her name is Selena Murphy, and she has had a terrible day, a truly awful day. And she's headed home on her commuter train, and of course, you know, as the way it always goes, the train just stalls. It dies on the track. So she's sitting there in the dark, and she finds herself next to a beautiful stranger. And the stranger strikes up a conversation with a confession. And I don't know, maybe it's the dark of the train or this awful day that she's had, or maybe it's the drink that she shouldn't have had, but Selena winds up sharing a dark secret of her own, something that she has never shared with anybody else. And then, you know, the train comes back to life and Selena is headed into the world and she's embarrassed. You know, she thinks, why would I ever share this thing with somebody I've never met before? And she hopes that she's never going to see the beautiful woman from the train ever again. But of course, she will.
Because otherwise we wouldn't have a story.
Otherwise there would not be a book, and that wouldn't be talking right now.
That's right. So it seems like most of your novels, or at least the ones I'm familiar with, have a female protagonist.
True.
And in kind of living a normal Instagrammable life. Mm-hmm. And they run into the worst of our nightmares.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a theme that runs through the work is, you know, sort of the ordinary woman, you know, or ordinary person in an extraordinary circumstance. And so that definitely does come up again and again in the work. And, you know, I think ever since I sort of, like, read my first thriller, which was, like, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, is very much has that energy, and so I think that, you know, in many ways that's like an inspiration that I kind of go back to again and again, because that's, you know, the place, that's the crucible where you can most easily sort of, you know, break down human nature, like what does a normal person do on their worst day, and that's what interests me as a writer.
Now you get into some pretty dark territory. So what does your mind look like inside?
That's a really good question. I've always had a very sort of just dark imagination. I've always had a lot of questions about the dark side of human nature. And I always kind of think of myself as, like, you know, if you're in the movies and there's a girl and she's headed down into the basement because, you know, she's heard a noise down there. She wants to see what it is. And everybody in the theater is going, you know,
don't
go down to the basement. But she goes, anyway, that's me. I'm the girl heading down into the basement to figure out what's there, you know. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, like, I live in the life, in the light. I don't come from any, you know, real trauma or even, you know, anything more than the most banal dysfunction. And so I guess I'm just always curious about what is the other side of, you know, of life. You know, what is the other, you know, what is, what are, what are the things underneath? And I'm always exploring that in my books.
Do you think that sometimes people who meet you for the first time are hesitant to become friends because they think you must have a real dark side?
All the time. Sometimes people are just like, you know, wow, you seem so nice. You seem like such a normal person. I'm like, I am a normal person. I just sort of exercise all my demons onto the page. Yeah, and truthfully, you know, the person who sits down to write is not necessarily the person that gets up, you know, to, you know, make a tuna fish sandwich and take my daughter to school or like whatever it is. It's a very different part of my brain. I'm very compartmentalized in, you know, my life as a writer and my life as a, you know, as a person. And so it's kind of interesting. It's kind of a bit of a fracture.
Well, obviously a lot of people have that fracture because they love reading this stuff.
Right.
They may not be able to write it, but they sure do love reading. And it goes back, I mean, you mentioned Rebecca Daphne du Maurier, which I'm sure I read as a teenager.
Yeah.
But I think I need to revisit that.
Oh, I think you should. You should definitely read it again as an adult because it totally stands up. It's just an excellent novel. I mean, it's really just, it's perfect suspense, really. It's a perfectly paced, you know, character-driven, interesting story and just brilliantly written. I mean, I would definitely suggest reading it again. Also, there's another book that I guess it would be from the 50s by Charlotte Armstrong called Mischief. And again, another like sort of ordinary mom in, you know, extraordinary circumstances and, you know, very, very forward thinking for its time, incredibly gripping and, you know, stands up, has some of those same themes that, you know, you'll find in Confessions, you know, like sort of this domestic life that, like, you know, has some fractures and, you know, a predator finds, you know, finds her way in to the family. And it's, you know, I guess it's kind of a universal theme or maybe like a timeless theme, you know, this idea that, you know, we all want to create this perfect existence and sometimes, you know, it's not possible. And, you know, there are fractures and people exploit that.
Well, the genre, in a sense, of the woman who's both the hero and the victim, in a way, in the story, it goes clear back to, like, Jane Eyre.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Yeah, Jane Eyre is a perfect example of that. Like, that's one of my all-time favorite books. She's, you know, she's a great example of that. If somebody, it's almost like she comes of age, you know what I mean? Like she starts off as one thing, you know, she's from abuse and, you know, she finds herself in a dark situation and then she also rescues herself, you know, in a very real way as she kind of comes into her power, into the, you know, the seat of her strength as a woman. And I think that's true for Selena too.
Now, is Selena, is there any of you in Selena?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I think she's really sort of the kind of woman a lot of us know, you know, in many ways. You know, she's like that superwoman that this culture is so great in creating. You know, like you're a mom and you have a big career and you, you know, you have a house and a husband and a life and, you know, there's this energy that you pour into like sort of curating your existence. And, you know, she's like very, you know, she's very much so like aware of herself as having like an Instagrammable life.
I love you know? That. I love that because I'm really exploring social media right now.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are really taking a closer look at that.
And my mother recently got on Facebook. She's not, she's not with us today. She's 85.
All right.
And it's been really interesting watching her Facebook and Instagram. And she did it to connect with other family members who aren't here. Mm-hmm. But she gets so frustrated.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's difficult,
she's like,
you know.
Yeah. She's like, why is this stuff showing up? I don't want this. I go, it's advertising.
That's what they're doing. That's why
you know?
<they're> there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's definitely, the social media, the Instagrammable life type of ideas, something, and also technology in general is something that's kind of worked its way into my novels, especially in recent years, because it's such a big part of our culture right now. And there's so many problems with it. And, especially in, yeah, the problem is that, it's basically just a hook in to get you to watch advertising. I mean, that's like the bottom line of social media. I mean, we all need to be aware of that. But more than that, if you're online and you're not guarding your privacy, protect, your privacy by, employing certain protections, it's very much so that you're giving away your information. And it's not just to advertisers. You're telegraphing all different things about your life. You're telegraphing things that you don't even realize that you're sharing. You may where you they know what you eat, where you were last Friday, where your kid goes to school, where your mom was last week. Like they know all of this because you're basically telling them.
It makes it pretty easy for a stalker.
It does. It makes it incredibly easy for a stalker or a con artist, which
Yeah, which is
is a big feature of Confessions on the 745.
absolutely. The interesting thing about, as I was reading the book and you talk about her, she was curating her life, and she has some self, Selena has some self-awareness that that's what she's doing. And of course, curate is kind of a buzzword that has come about in the last, I don't know, 5, 6 years. But the thing that's, and I have some, friends and family members that when I look at their Facebook and Instagram and so forth, and I don't think that's really what's going on in their lives. Because, but the opposite of that is that we have this real thirst for authenticity, but it's like the authenticity becomes curated. Well, then it's not very authentic. So
Well, yeah, I
how
mean,
do you
that's so
bridge that
true.
gap?
Yeah, it's really true because, and I think that it's something, it's a disservice that you're not only doing a disservice to yourself, you're doing a disservice to everybody else, right? Like your real life is the life that is lived between the posts that you put out on Facebook and Instagram. That's your life. If you've taken a moment to, snap a picture of your messy kitchen, however, like whatever flawed thing you're looking to show to, like, kind of humble brag, like, oh, look at my beautiful kitchen, so messy from baking all these cookies. Like, you've really thought about that. You've sat down, you've thought about it, you've taken that picture, you've cropped it and filtered it, and you've posted it on the internet. That is not authentic by any means.
True. That is very true.
And it's like, I think that it require, I think it requires some attention being paid to it, because when you do things like that, you're not only hurting yourself, you're not only making yourself crazy, because you are, but you're also making everybody else feel bad. People who are not necessarily, don't have the energy or the wherewithal to like create a picture perfect version of their life for Instagram. You're also making those people who are actually actively trying to live a life and take care of their kids and do, you're making those people often feel bad because they're like, wow, I can't pull it together to get this thing done. And we could all be a little bit more relaxed, I think, if we could, in fact, be authentic with each other.
Somebody should start a platform that only allows like real posts.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder how that would, I don't know if you could do that.
That could
Like,
be
don't bring
interesting,
any of your
though.
made-up stuff here. Just,
This is for the real
I
stuff.
want the picture of you that you, like, when you
Without makeup.
accidentally turned your phone on
Oh,
and, like, from a
Lord.
really horrible angle. I want that picture. That's the only one you're allowed to post.
Yeah, maybe not that,
Maybe,
but
okay, not that one, but something else, something a little bit less, like,
yeah.
whatever.
Less
There's a, I mean,
staged, less
right, less staged,
staged,
less, a little bit less staged, a little more
more authentic.
authentic,
Yeah,
yeah.
more authentic. I'm trying to picture what that would be exactly,
I don't
but
know. I can't
it could
imagine.
be interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Lisa Unger, author of Confessions on the 745. Well, Lisa, why don't you read from the prologue of the book so that our listeners can really get a feel for it?
Absolutely, I would love to. She watched, That was her gift. To disappear into the black, sink into the shadows behind and between. That's where you really saw things for what they were, when people revealed their true natures. Everyone was on broadcast these days, thrusting out versions of themselves, cropped and filtered for public consumption. Everyone putting on the show of me. It was when people were alone, unobserved, that the mask came off. She'd been watching him for a while. The mask he wore was slipping. He, too, stood in the shadows of the street, a hulking darkness. She'd followed him as he drove, circling like a predator, then finding a place for his car under the trees. He'd parked, then sat as the night wound on and inside lights went out, one by one. Finally, he stepped out of his vehicle, closed the door quietly, and slipped across the street. Now he waited. What was he doing? Since she'd been following him the last few weeks, she'd seen him push his children on the swings in the park, visit a strip club in the middle of the day, drink himself stupid with his buddies watching a game at a sports bar. She'd watched as he'd helped a young mother with a toddler and a baby in a carriage carry her groceries from her car to her house. Once, he'd picked up a woman in a local bar. Then, out in the parking lot, they'd romp like animals in his car. Later, he went to the grocery store and picked up food for his family, his cart piled high with ice cream and Goldfish crackers, things his kids liked. What was he up to now? The observer only sees, never interferes. Still, tonight she felt the jingle of bad possibilities. She waited in the cool night, patient and still. The clicking of heels echoed, brisk staccato up the deserted street. She felt a little pulse of dread. Was there no one else around? No one else glancing out their window? No, she was the only one. Sometimes, didn't it seem like people didn't see anymore? They didn't look out. They looked down at the device in their hands, or in, mesmerized by the movie of the past and future, desires and fears, always playing on the screen in their minds. The figure of the young woman was slim, erect, confident. She marched up the street, sure-footed, hands in her pockets, tote over her shoulder. When he moved out of the darkness and blocked her path, the young woman stopped short, backed up a step or two. He reached for her, as if to take her hand, but she wrapped her arms around her middle. There were words she couldn't hear, an exchange, sharp at first, then softer. On the air, far away, they sounded like calling birds. What was he doing? Fear was a cold finger up her spine. He moved to embrace the girl, and she shrank away. But he moved in anyway. In the night, he was just a looming specter. His bulk swallowed her tiny form, and together, in a kind of dance, they moved toward the door, first jerking, awkward. Then she seemed to give in, soften into him. She let them both inside, and then the street was silent again. She stood frozen, unsure of what she'd seen. Later, when she realized what he'd done, who he truly was under the mask, she'd hate herself for staying rooted, hiding in the shadows, only watching. She'd tell herself that she didn't know then. She didn't know that beneath the mask, he was a monster.
And that was Lisa Unger reading from the prologue of Confessions on the 745. Now, men don't come off real well in your book.
They don't.
is that usually the case, or well, there's one kind of heroic guy.
Yeah, I think, well, it's interesting because, you know, I never have a lot of perspective on these things until after the book is written. You know, my process is so subconscious, and, you know, it has already come up a couple times in various different interviews that, you know, it's pretty harsh for the men in this book. Not all of them. You know, there are a couple of good guys, a couple of, like, sort of upright guys that, you know, are, you know, doing the right thing, you know, for their wives and their families and stuff. But, you know, it is a sort of a dark perspective on men from these women, from the characters in this book, because it's very much their story, Selena and Pearl. And it's very much so, you know, about where they come from. And they both come from, you know, either abandonment or abuse or dysfunction in their families, mainly because of the men who have formed them. And so it's very much the story about their journey. And both of them have a journey, and they start off the book as one thing, and they both wind up at the end as something else. You know, they take agency over themselves and responsibility for who they are, and they, you know, they fight for what's right for them in their lives. But they both come from, you know, a very, very dark place. And I think that that's the perspective that they bring for, you know, on men and men in the world.
And there's a commentary in here, too, on the women who let the men get away with stuff. And that's kind of a very topical commentary right now, because with the Me Too movement and the number of situations where women almost seem to enable men's bad behavior.
Yeah, there's, you know, there's definitely some layers of that in the book as well. Like there's a, you know, there's a part, you know, think even when Selena is thinking about Geneva and, you know, she sort of explores like kind of the layer of possible exploitation, you know, like Graham is in a power position, you know, did he come on to Geneva? Did she feel that she had to acquiesce in order to keep her job? So there are always these layers of, you know, of blame and who's responsible and, you know, what is the real truth of, you know, certain situations. And, you know, there's also sort of the element of Cora, who is Selena's mom, how she kind of enabled Selena's father in many ways for many years, sort of turning a blind eye to his many, many affairs. And, you know, there's a long sort of analysis like throughout the book about, you know, why Cora made these decisions, how Selena has now found herself in a similarly dark place, making the same choice in some ways for, you know, reasons that she thinks are different, but are not.
Yeah.
Actually.
And she never really forgave her mother for that.
Right.
For having done that until she finds herself in a similar situation.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, just kind of, you know, realizing that, you know, as a woman, you know, as a mother, there's almost nothing that you won't endure if you think it's going to spare your child pain. Right?
Right.
Like, and so Selena has to kind of, you know, come to terms with that with her own, you know, in her conversations with her own son and, you know, try to understand that looking back to Cora, who enabled this and, you know, had let this sort of dysfunction and darkness kind of fester, that even as, you know, even if we're not really fully aware of the pain in our parents' like very bad relationship, like the shock waves of that dysfunction can be felt way into our adulthood and inform the choices that we make about the men that we let into our lives. And we may not even be aware of that. You know, we may not even know. I chose this guy because on some level, I'm still trying to fix my father.
Mm.
I'm still trying to, you know, be the one who, you know, makes him okay for our family. And these are all, you know, subliminal choices and things that we're not even often aware of until we're faced with the consequences of the choices that we've made, which is not to victim blame, right? It's not to make women responsible for the bad actions of men. But it is to say, you know, you have to sometimes, when you're in pain in a dark relationship, you have to look at why you made the choices that you did make. Where is your power? How do you seize it? How do you make a change for yourself?
You know, I feel like Selena was very believable in that she was never really wimpy.
No.
So it wasn't like this complete wimp who suddenly finds her strength. There was...
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't know that, you know, some people, you know, have more agency than other people. Some people are more, you know, battered than other people. Some people have more inner strength. I mean, I don't really think that, you know, like if a person who finds themselves trapped in a dark situation isn't necessarily, you know, wimpy or weak. They just may not have the agency. They may not have access to the agency that they have. You know what I mean? And it takes a while. Sometimes it takes a long time, and sometimes people never come, you know, never come to terms. But, you know, I think that Selena never, you know, she's always been, you know, kind of a tough girl. You know, she's always been a fighter, and she recognizes that in herself. But she kind of has put that part of herself to bed a little bit in that, you know, she's like, you know, she even looks at that. Like, I put that, you know, I was always the one, you know, standing up to the bullies on the playground. You know, how did I become, you know, the woman who can't stand up for herself in her marriage?
Yeah. Although, so, you know, there's also the fact that she didn't realize how bad he really was.
Right. And, right. No,
and
no,
there are things that can be forgiven.
Yes. And you do. There are infidelities and there are broken things in a marriage. And you do kind of go, okay, you know, you screwed up and, or I did, and let's heal ourselves so that we can stay a family for our kids. And I still love you and let's move forward. And so I think she was very much in that place, even though she knew there were already fractures in the marriage. She was very much in that place where she thought they'd come through it. When she realizes, you know, he's still behaving badly, though, of course, she doesn't realize how badly.
Right. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Lisa Unger, author of Confessions on the 745. So, Lisa, do you put a book out every year, every 2 years? What's your schedule that you're on here?
I've been doing a book a year now for the last 18 years.
Oh, wow. That's a long time.
I think there have been some gaps. I think there have been, like, you know, maybe it's been 18 months between books just because of, you know, various mainly publishing schedules, you know, moving a book to a different month for various reasons, but not because I haven't, you know, been able to do a book a year. That's pretty comfortable for me, even. You know, I have a daughter, she's almost 15 now, so, you know, my schedule is a little bit different than it was when she was, you know, a toddler and a, you know, preschooler and all that stuff, and things are pretty crazy, but she sort of owns herself a little bit these days, and so my schedule has kind of expanded, and a book a year is pretty comfortable for me. It's harder for me not to write. And it is for me to write.
Well, that's a good position to be in. Do you, so like this book, when would you have finished writing it?
About this time last year.
And
yeah, I would have turned it in right before The Stranger Inside.
And when was it released? When was Confessions on the 745 released?
The 6th of October.
Okay. So
yeah, it takes about a year.
About a year ago you finished writing it, and now you're doing the publicity for it and promoting the book. Is it hard for you to get back into that book when you've already written another one and probably are starting on a second one?
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm always happy to go back to it, you know, and start talking about it. I mean, it's kind of just the way of it. Like right now I'm very intensely working on the editorial phase of my book that'll come out next year. So I'm very involved with that. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I write, you know, my process is very subconscious. You know, I write from a, like, you know, very deep and internal place. And so, you know, as I'm writing, I'm not, you know, I don't know who's going to show up day to day. I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know entirely what the book is about. And I definitely don't know how it's going to end. And so, you know, it takes me a while after I've written it, edited it, and then, you know, we've done a number of proofreading drafts. It takes me a while to really, you know, get a sense of, like, what did I write? What did I do? Why did I write this? What does this mean to me? And so it takes a little bit of perspective. It takes almost this much time to be able to sit down and talk about it and talk about the characters and talk about, you know, the layers of the story and all that. And so it's actually quite nice to just be with the book, you know, as it is, the story as it evolved and, you know, came to fruition, to be with it and to just really look at it from this place and talk about it with people like you and book groups and stuff like that. It's actually quite Nice to do that.
Well, Lisa, for Confessions on the 745, if you didn't really know who was going to show up, and how it was going to end, what was the starting point?
Oh, so that's interesting. Yeah, so there's always a germ, right? There's always something. It could be like a line of poetry, or it might be a news story or a picture, or it could be, you know, in one case it was a piece of junk mail. And so in this case, I just had this idea kicking around in my head for a while, which probably was a piece I picked up from other research I was doing. And it was this idea that you can't con an honest man. And I thought, it has the ring of truth, but, you know, it seems a little simplistic. And, you know, nothing in human psychology is ever simple. So it got me to thinking about it more and doing some research. And I wanted to bring it up on a panel of thriller writers when we were in the green room, just chit-chatting. And a writer friend of mine was like, I don't know, that kind of sounds like victim blaming to me. And I was like, yeah, I hear that. That sounds right. And so I started, you know, doing some research into the psychology of the con artist and the conned. And so I found a book called The Confidence Game by Maria Konnikova. And it's a really fascinating book about, you know, the psychology of the con man. It's some stories about some famous con artists and some people that she met and interviewed, as well as a breakdown of, like, common scams and, you know, kind of the psychology of the mark as well, the conned. And what I took away from the book was that, you know, most people think that they are, you know, they're impervious to scams, that they're way too smart or too worldly to ever fall for any one of these, like, sort of common, you know, hoaxes that we hear about all the time.
But the Nigerian prince.
Is, exactly, the Nigerian prince. And she actually writes about that in the book. And, you know, that, the more convinced that we are that we're too smart to fall for things, the more likely it is that we fall victim to a con artist. And so I came away with a different idea, a different sort of feeling or thought, and that was that you can't con somebody who doesn't want something. Mm-hmm. And everybody wants something. And so everybody is vulnerable to a con artist. And so that was the seed, that was the germ for the book. And then at that point, you know, when I had been doing my research and you're really thinking about this for a long time, I, you know, started hearing the voices of Selena and Pearl, and it was those voices that I followed through the manuscript.
Okay. Now, some of the cons that that you describe that are sort of from the, I don't know what you call them, Pearl's sort of dad. Pop.
Yeah,
Pop.
Harley.
We'll call him Pop.
Yeah.
Did you, like, find those? Were they, how did you research to be able to write those parts?
Yeah, they're pretty, I mean, I've been, and to be honest, like, I've been doing this kind of research for a long time, so it wasn't just one book. So it's, like, always, you know, kind of, you know, my whole life is, like, sort of research. I'm kind of, like, an information junkie, so I'm always taking in, like, little pieces of information, and this is definitely something that I think about a lot. And so pieces of it are from the book, and pieces of it are from things that I already know, and, you know, certain things are just, you know, kind of common knowledge. It's, like, common scams, like the sweetheart scam is a really common one. And, those are the kind of things that fascinate me the most. You know, it's like the con, especially because it's not a smash and grab. You know, it's not a robbery. You know, these people, you know, they sort of are excellent at working their way into your life. And you like them. You know, they're charismatic and charming, and you want, you know, they're offering you something that you want, and you take it, you know, whether it's love or a need to be a hero or whatever it is, they know what you want and they give it to you. And so you in turn give them what they came for all along. So there's a lot of research that went into it, and it's definitely something that I was super interested in exploring.
Well, it seems in some ways that there's a fine line between what would you almost call a normal exchange and a con.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. And then once you read the book, then you start looking at a lot of other things as potential cons, like things that we kind of take for granted, right? I mean, you think about things like, just very normal things, like, say the average, like, 30-year fixed mortgage, right? I mean, if you look at it, right, and you really look at those, that you go in, you sign for your mortgage, and it's like that gigantic stack of paper. It's like 2 inches thick, right? And you go through page after page, and it's like they actually have to make you look at what you're paying for your house at the end of this 30-year payment process. And you actually look at that number, that interest number, what you paid. You've really almost paid double for your house.
Oh yeah, and believe me, when I the first mortgage I ever got
Yeah.
was 13% interest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh my
So you can imagine that.
Yeah. And you
And
kind of like, and it's just really common. Most people do it. If you're lucky enough to even be able to get a mortgage, most people do it. And then all of a sudden, after you kind of realize how these games work, you start looking at a lot of things like, wow, is this just a con that we're all complicit in?
yeah. By the way, that was back in the 80s. We had
Yeah.
some heavy duty inflation and high interest rates for a while. Of course, you could also
Yeah.
get 12% on a CD. So if
Yeah,
you
well,
had money,
exactly.
yeah, that was
Right, exactly right. Yeah. There's no
great.
12% CDs now, that's for sure.
Yeah, you're lucky if you get 2%.
Exactly.
I mean, when I was younger, a passbook savings account paid 5.25%. All of them
Yeah,
did.
yeah,
And
yeah.
it was and that was the legal limit. They couldn't pay more.
Right,
That
right.
and but every, they all paid that. And now if you could get 5% on a savings account, that would be
Oh my
like
God, I know, it's
amazing.
amazing. Well, you have to, and then you, I mean, and that's another thing you have to look at too. Like, why did that change? And then all of a sudden, you have to put your money into the stock market if you want any real gains. So, who won that con? Like, who talk about the long game.
Now, we
You
don't
know.
have the issues with inflation that we did back then. So
True.
there's that offset it, offsets it somewhat. But
Yeah.
yeah, who is, well, it's obvious
Well, we
that
know.
yeah, that the wealth is getting concentrated more and more.
Yes,
And
absolutely. Absolutely. I can't believe it's by accident or these like sort of accidental, oh, it was,
yeah,
inflation
but I
or
also can't
like,
believe that any of those people were smart enough to actually do it intentionally.
Right. Well, yeah. I
That's
mean, now you sound like my dad. That's the argument I have with my dad all the time. He's like, "You're a conspiracy theorist." I was like, "No, I'm not." He's like, "People are just, He's like, "Nobody's smart enough to do this stuff on purpose." I'm like, "I don't know if that's true."
they can be smart enough to set up the rules in their favor. That's certainly
Exactly.
true.
Exactly.
But
Right. They don't know how good it's going to get for them, right, or
right.
not.
Where I
So.
draw the line on conspiracy theories, though, is some great big secretive joint
Like
effort.
Pavel, yeah.
Yeah, because and there's a line, I think at least twice in your book that explains why. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't. Tell
Why
me.
I don't believe in those that type of conspiracy theory?
No, tell me.
Three of us can keep a secret if two of us are
Oh,
dead.
yeah.
It's like, no, there's no way there's all these
So
people meeting
true.
together and making these decisions and then doing it and it's all this and
Right,
nobody
somebody's gonna
knows.
blow the whistle when they get cut out of the deal,
Oh
right?
yeah. Oh yeah. Or
That's
someone's
very
gonna
true.
tell somebody pillow talk or brag about something.
Exactly.
People
Yeah, you're
brag
right.
about
You're
things.
right.
There's
Thank
just
goodness.
no
Yay,
way.
good. No conspiracies then. People are not smart enough.
Exactly. So what you mentioned that your writing's very subconscious. So kind of describe to us what a typical writing day looks like for you.
Yeah, I am, I'm a very early writer. I try to write first thing in the morning. My most golden creative hours are probably from 5 a.m. to noon. I try to write as close to when I wake up as possible so that I can like kind of stay inside that dream brain it's best to write before everybody wakes up, you know, in my house, and, you know, before the world wakes up. And so I try to write as early as possible. I do, you know, I have a daughter, so, and she's home right now, so she's like, you know, like virtual virtual learning. And so, you know, I do tend to work around her school schedule. You know, also I'm a professional writer, so if I don't get those, you know, those solid hours, you know, for whatever reason, family or work or book launch or whatever, I can write at any other time of the day, and do so. But that's really my golden time. So on the best day, I get a creative cycle in before my daughter ever wakes up, and then I'll take a break and have breakfast with her, or take her to school, and then go back to the work. And then, you know, from, you know, hopefully from at least 8 to 4, that's a solid creative cycle that is not interrupted by anything, including anything like social media or the internet or anything like that.
How do you and avoid then, it?
Oh, you've got to block it. You've got to block it. Yeah, you can't. You cannot allow that to interfere with the creative cycles.
But it's, do you ever, like, you're at a point and you need to know something, so you have to look it up?
Yeah, I tend to wait because once you're there, you're down the rabbit hole.
Exactly.
I mean, we all know that, right?
Yeah.
So I read this book a while back called Deep Work by Cal Newport, and it really, he also has a podcast, and it really changed the way I worked. And, you know, I came to it like at a point where just feeling like very mentally like kind of burned out. And I realized that, you know, there is no possibility of doing deep creative work if you are perpetually switching out to do shallow social media, email, internet stuff. Mm. So the key thing is to batch your creative time, to make sure that when you have set your intention to do the deep creative work of writing a novel, that you are going to only be doing that for a set period of time. And it's a, you know, it's a discipline these days because, you know, it has like sort of leaked into every single element of our lives, especially now with the pandemic. Like, you know, we're probably all lost a battle that we were fighting with the screen, at least somewhat. So it's very important to, for me, to have that creative time be a sacred time that is not interrupted by other stuff. And if there are things I need to research, I'll do it afterwards.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So when you're writing, are you on computer for your first draft?
Yeah, sometimes, most times, but I also do write longhand. Sometimes I just need a break from the screen altogether, and sometimes some books just want to be totally written longhand, and I have written some books almost completely in a notebook, and that, you know, obviously requires me to transpose into the computer, which is sort of the first layer of the editorial process for me. So, sometimes I do write longhand, but, you know, most often it's at my computer.
And do you edit as you go, or are you someone who just writes very quickly in first draft mode and doesn't do any self-editing in that process?
There's always editing for me, because most of my days start with me reading what I wrote the day before. So I will, you know, and as soon as my eyes are on anything, I'm rewriting, you know, so that's kind of the way of it. So, you know, I might be editing, rewriting, reworking, you know, in that, those last pages, and then flow into what comes next. So there's some editing, while I'm writing the first draft.
And then when you get through the first draft, how much editing, you know, how many times do you go through it, and how much, like, of the, let's say you're spending, I don't know, are you spending 6 months writing the book?
It could be, you know, it's more like 9 to 12 months
okay.
for a first draft. And then once I'm finished with the first draft, I generally put it aside, you know, maybe for a week, you know, maybe not quite that long. And then I go back to it and start to read from page 1. and do another draft. And I might do that two or three times before I hand it in to my editor.
And then, is anybody reading as you go? Do you have any readers?
My husband reads.
Great.
My husband reads, and occasionally my agent will read, but mainly not. Mainly I need to be with it until I'm 100% sure that it's the best that I can make it. And then at a certain point, you know, I turn it into my editor. And then after that, there'll be a conversation. We'll basically just sit down and talk about it, and she'll have notes and she'll have thoughts. And then I go back to the manuscript with that conversation in my head, and I start from page one, and I do an editorial rewrite of the book. And then after that point, you know, then there's like line editing. After that, then there's copy editing. And then there's proofreading drafts. There's two proofreading drafts after that. And then I always ask for first pass, which is the after the book has been typeset and after it's already gone to galley, which is an uncorrected proof of the book. I always like first pass because I want to read it one last time before it goes.
Okay, so you've read this book a dozen times.
Yeah, at least.
Now, in Confessions on the 745, were there any characters that like showed up that surprised you? That, you know, what are they doing here, and how do they fit in?
Yeah, they all surprised me. I'm in a constant state of being surprised. You know, if I wasn't, I wouldn't be able to write the book.
Mm.
You know, so the characters reveal themselves to me in layers, much the way my readers learn about them. And so, you know, in a very real sense, I write for the same reason that I read, you know, because I want to know what's going to happen to the people living in my head.
Ah. Do you ever you say you don't know where it's going to end, how it's going to end, but at what point do you know? That you have to know at some point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the end.
At the end. Okay, yeah. But, you know, as I'm...
No, I know.
But I'm reading Confessions on the 745, and there was a point where I kind of knew where it was going.
Okay.
But, you know, not 100%, but, you know, okay, so... And there's a point where you reveal some, you know, before the end, where part of the mystery is revealed.
Yes.
So at that point, do you kind of know how you're wrapping it up?
I mean, I might know, like to a certain to some degree, you know. But I guess, you know, it's interesting because I've had this conversation before. Like, you know, I've been a writer since I was a kid. Even before that, I was a reader. You know, that's where all writers are readers first, right?
Right.
And that's where we fall in love with story. And so then beyond that, you know, beyond being, you know, a lifelong reader and a lifelong writer, my entire education is focused on writing, pretty much, writing and literature. And, you know, I'm kind of like have always been a literary omnivore, right, in that, you know, I just read everything that I, you know, any kind of, any, across genre, across, you know, everything from literary to science fiction and back again. You know, I read just because a great story is a great story no matter where it exists, right?
Right.
And so I've sort of in a really, really true sense, you know, I have kind of internalized the form of a novel. You know, that's my voice. I started my first, you know, full novel when I was 19 years old. And it's a very much so, it's part of me. Like, it's kind of almost the way my brain works. Like, my subconscious brain, like, knows how to tell a story better than my conscious brain knows how to tell it. So as I'm writing, you know, the story is evolving for me. You know, I kind of have a sense that the story's there, and I'm just trying to find it. I'm just trying to uncover it. You know, there is a very definable arc, you know, to every story, and you kind of feel it, you know, or I kind of feel it in the writing. You know, at the beginning of a book, you know, you're kind of, getting to know the characters. Things are sort of, you know, our layers are being peeled back. You know, you're seeing back into the past in some cases, and, you know, into the future in other cases. And, you know, you're sort of doing this, you know, you're on this journey, I guess, with the characters and the stories. And you kind of feel the arc, right? You can feel when you're kind of at the top, and then things really start to speed up from there. And so the writing becomes very intense at that point, too. You know, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot more energy, a lot more hours, you know, in any given day, and the writing goes a lot faster.
I was going to say, do you get to the point where you almost can't put the pen down or the,
absolutely,
or the computer down?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. We have, you know, there's usually like a couple weeks at the end of a novel where I'm just like, you know, in there and any time I can be working on it. And then, you know, you kind of do, you have a sense of how the story is going to go and how it's going to unfold, but it happens in the writing. It happens on the page. It's not like you may have pieces that come to you off the page, like when you're exercising or when you're dreaming or when you wake up, like, oh my God, this is it, right? Like, you know, you have those feelings, but it can't ever be until it's on the page. Mm-hmm. And so that's very much the way it works for me. Like, even to the point where if I'm trying to think about and figure out how things are going to go or what's going to happen next, then I can't do it until I'm actually writing.
Wow. So yeah. In Confessions on the 745, it's told from multiple points of view and multiple time frames that are sort of interspersed, and you don't really know that at the beginning. You don't know that some of the
right.
what's being told happened before other parts that were told
yes.
earlier. Is this a common structure that you use?
I have used this structure before, multiple voices, multiple time periods. So, and it's really just a matter of the way the story sort of presents itself to me. Sometimes it's like a very urgent first-person voice, and it's one character, and it's her story usually. Occasionally it's been a male voice, but mainly it's a woman. And, you know, and then I follow that very urgent first-person voice, and it's a little bit more linear. And when there's multiple perspectives, though, and multiple timelines, and then it presents itself to me more like a mosaic. Right, like, so there are all these different little pieces, and then once they're gathered, that's when you're going to see the full picture.
Do you write it in the order that it ends up in the book, or did you sometimes
generally
mix
speaking,
things up?
Yeah, generally speaking, structurally, when I'm at the end of a first draft, it's about 95% where it's going to be structurally. But there's not a lot of moving around of pieces in the editorial phase.
I would think it would be harder to write it this way, the third person, multiple point of view, multiple timelines, than a direct first person. Do you find that to be true?
I don't know if I would. I don't know if I would say that. Everything has like a sort of a different element to it. You know, in the third person, you have a little bit more distance from the characters, so you see everything a little bit more clearly. Like, you're a little bit more aware of, like, sort of the bigger picture. Sometimes in a first person narrative, you're very much inside that character headspace. And even though it can be more propulsive, it's, you know, with a multiple perspective book, you can go to different pieces to tell your story. From a first person perspective, you can only use that one perspective to tell your story. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah. It does. It does, certainly.
Yeah. So they both, you know, so I enjoy both ways of telling a story, and I don't really actually feel like I choose it. Like, the story tells itself the way it wants to be told. So it's not like I could never go, oh, you know what, I think I need to change this to first person. Like, that could never happen. Like, it just wouldn't be possible.
Have you ever had a book that you started writing and it just wasn't working and you put it aside?
Maybe early, you know, early in my, you know, in my writing life, mm-hmm. you know, obviously as a young person, you know, you start things that, you know, just, you know, don't finish. I, you know, it's interesting that, there's a, my, my eighth novel, Fragile, is probably one of the most personal novels, and there's a piece in it that was something from my childhood. And I tried to tell that story a lot of different ways, like since I was a teenager. And it was almost like it could never, it never evolved onto the page. It never became a novel, right? I had these pieces and these voices, and they just never came together. And but that, you know, I was you know, young at that time, and I was like a new writer. And then so when I started writing Fragile, I mean, and because it's the way I write, I was 25% into the book when I realized, oh, this is it. This is finally the piece. And I thought, you know, at having perspective on it later, I realized that, you know, I needed to be a better writer. I needed to be a mother. I needed to be a wife. I needed some distance from the thing that had occurred in my childhood in order to have any perspective on it at all. And I had to wait for it to have its time.
Well, Lisa, we are about out of time. But I have one last question. Do you ever have dueling stories in your head trying to get written, and you have to decide which one to go with?
Not usually. I mean, it's usually pretty, you know, much so when I'm in a novel, it's, you know, it's a very deep, like sort of long and enduring relationship. And, you know, I'm very fully involved in it. And then by the time it's over, I'm probably already thinking about what might be coming next. I probably already have a thought or some research that I'm doing or a voice in my head and all that. So it pretty much, you know, kind of goes like that. There's never like a point where I'm like working on a book and then like something else cuts in. Like, I have to work on this. Like, no, you know, that's not really how it works for me. I may occasionally write short stories while I am writing a novel. But that's a different relationship. Like a novel is like, you know, that's a marriage, and story
is a fling. Well, it sure sounds like you're in the flow when it comes to writing. So Lisa, I want to thank you for being with us today. Really enjoyed this conversation.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it as well. I really appreciate the time.
And I'm going to give a little quote. Usually my mother does that at the end, but this is, I think, apropos. From Abe Lincoln, you can fool all the people some of the time and some of the people all the time, but you cannot fool all the people all the time.
Yes, that works very well in this context, for sure.
And thank you for listening, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.